Exercising Compassion in Contemporary Life is the title. A little background of where the title came from. Hi, can you hear me without this?
Oh, it's good.
Ready this?
Yeah.
It's good. Okay. One of the ways that I'm serving the society of devotees and serving Krishna is I serve as a governing body commission member. We even have an acronym, it's called GBC. So I have some responsibility for maintaining spiritual standards within a certain geographic area within the United States. And we have globally around 35 such persons, and then each year there's an election of officers, and 2 years ago I served as the chairman of that GBC Global, and it was a very interesting experience. Towards the end I was thinking and saying, expressing, I think everybody should have the opportunity at least 1 year out of their life to serve as the chairman of the GBC, because it's such a nice learning experience. Very challenging in many ways. And one thing that happened during that year was the crisis in Haiti. So prior to being in that chairman position, I was just like all of you, like, you know, a face in the crowd, an audience member, and somebody else thought about those things, and I didn't have to think about those things. But what do you do when something like that happens? It was particularly giving leadership to an international, global society of spiritual-minded people. When something like that crisis in Haiti happened, what do you do? What's appropriate? And you can make a long list of things that might be possible. What can you do and what should you do? So, what happened was there were persons in our society from all over that were contacting me saying, you know, is there something going on? I'd like to help. So, Haiti is a place where we don't have a temple. The closest temple is in Santo Domingo. And so, I happen to know somebody that's a very responsible person in Santo Domingo. I called him up and said, are you willing to be the point person for people that want to come from around the world and help in Haiti? He said, sure. Okay. Expect some emails and some phone calls. And fast forward over a period of about 2 weeks, maybe around 40 persons went to Haiti. And I just happened to be passing through on our way to some meeting in London, and he was a person from Australia that knew how to build houses from next to nothing. Then another person from South Africa, they just happened to meet up so that they could go to Haiti together. Somebody from South Africa that knew how to grow things from seed to, like, you know, fruition. And he had his suitcases not filled with clothes but filled with seeds so that he could help them. Somebody else that was good with medical supplies and somebody else with this and that. And they all had their little group of friends that apparently they've done this before. Then another group came from the farm community in Hungary because they know their thing is sustainable agriculture. So around 40 people from all over the world went and rolled up their sleeves and helped. And the course of discussing with them, I was impressed at how resourceful the persons that were going. They just like carved out a chunk of time because they were capable, busy people with responsibilities like all the rest of us. They just took off some time and did that. And they had a very clear picture of what they would do also for the spiritual well-being of the people that were in distress. It's not just put them in the house and their lives are upside down. So spiritual counseling and spiritual centering, that was part of their task. And then not too much later, while I was still, towards the end of when I was the chairman, something happened similar in Chile. Now we had another something to respond to. It was, what are we going to do? You know, so I went through the same. So that made me, those two things helped me think about this title. And then my tenure as the chairman ended. I took a little, like, breath of fresh air and kind of put this on the shelf. And then this year, the thing in Japan happened. So I said, I want to speak about this and do something about this. So at a number of universities that we attended, we kind of connected with the Japanese Student Association. We invited them to co-participate with us in presenting this theme, and we had a fundraising dinner, and whatever proceeds went to Japan, because there's a group of 38 devotees presently in Japan, many of them from Nepal, some of them from other places, and some local Japanese devotees that are doing whatever they can do with limitations because of radioactivity. But so that's the background. It's not just major crises kind of calamities, but the everyday circumstances of life when someone is in a situation of difficulty. What's a spiritually minded person to do? So, contrast it simply. Can these lights go down? The image is an image of a lotus flower. You know, this is a number of lotus flowers at the end. So this is our logo. Whatever. Lotus symbolizes different things for different people. It sometimes symbolizes peace, or sometimes just the beauty of nature, a tranquil setting that's very serene. And for me, the lotus is connected to Krishna, and I'll explain that in just a minute. The daily picture of our universe is that it's like a big coconut. It's hollow inside, and inside there's many planets floating about, innumerable numbers, some finite, but so many you can't count them. And then the universe is covered by a thick shell. The shell is 7 layers, each layer 10 times the diameter of the previous one, and the first layer 10 times the diameter of the universe. You do the math, it works out that the universe is about 3/4 of an inch, like a ball bearing in diameter. Then coverings on the universe go out several miles. That was a thick shell, thick coconut shell. And then outside that shell of the universe, there's the vastness of the spiritual sky. And the spiritual sky is luminous, or jyoti, Brahma jyoti, more brilliant than thousands of suns. And within that vastness of the spiritual sky, there's spiritual planets called Vaikuntha planets. And amongst all of those Vaikuntha planets, there's one that's shaped like a lotus, and it's the largest amongst them. And in the world, or the center of that lotus, is where Krishna and all of his associates are engaged in their transcendental pastimes. Krishna being the emanating source of all compassion. So that's what lotus means to me. It makes me think of Krishna and his compassionate nature. So here's some very simple definitions of compassion, so we're going to start. This quote, what you see coming out, is just directly out of a dictionary. Two definitions. One that says compassion is the quality of understanding the suffering of others and wanting to do something about it. So it's a quality. It's focused on the suffering of others, and it's motivation, one wants to do something. And another definition, it's not identical, but it's different, related, a deep awareness and sympathy for another's suffering. So, it's a quality, something that we have within us. It's something that you feel deep within the core of your being, and it creates a compelling urge to be active, to do something in that mood of concern for others. This slide is taken, the colors are quite different from my colors, but it's taken from a presenter, you know what TED, T-E-D, the speaking group is? So a Chinese employee of Google was a speaker on TED after I made this presentation at Penn State University. Someone forwarded me the TED link, and he spoke on compassion at Google and what Google does as a culture of compassion and some of the things that they do. But he then presented, he's an engineer, but because he's so moved by the culture of compassion at Google, they hired him to make a curriculum for generating, you've maybe heard the book From Good to Excellent, like leadership in corporations. There's good, there's certain qualities, and when it's excellent, there's other qualities. So he has a course where he's combined that understanding with emotional intelligence. Some of you have heard that term before, emotional intelligence. It's about a decade old, but it's also based on compassion. So his course, a seminar that he's paid to do, he's presented in a very short way. It has these very same elements taken directly from the dictionary, something that you feel, or an affective component, a cognitive, an understanding about another person's situation, and a motivational component. You want to do something for another. So, affective, cognitive, motivational. This is compassion. Now what he's done is he's taken that principle of compassion and connected it to these two qualities that make a leader excellent. This Good to Excellent book says these two qualities, when they're present in the leader, make them excellent. Because humility says their nature is a leader, but their concern is about another. Their concern is not the old style. Like, you know, I'm going to leave you out because here I come, and you know, if you don't do it my way, you're out. My way or the highway. It's a very, very different approach. Very, very different approach. Where the needs of the other person is what you care about. You want to serve, like service organizations, you want to serve the needs of the other people. That's what's motivating you. And one who is excellent in that capacity is very humble. You feel for the other person, you understand the other person, but there's a strong drive to accomplish those things. Like an unstoppable drive. Highly motivated, highly ambitious towards a compassionate end. That makes an excellent leader. So he's paid to train people at Google about compassion, how to be excellent leaders within their groups that they work with. That was his TED presentation. So compassion doesn't just mean being a softie. Compassion means being excellent in how you extend service and care to others. Here's some quotes that help us show how some modern people, some a little bit older than modern people also, view compassion. I'll let you guess what that is. What Einstein said about compassion is, our task must be to free ourselves by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. So that's a pretty big compass of compassion. But the motivational end is to think as he was able to think, like out of the box, think where you're free. And the key to the freedom is compassion and expanding the capacity or circle or compass of that compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. So if you want to be, if you want freedom, or if you want to be able to think freely or think creatively and think brilliantly, be compassionate and expand the circle of your compassion. It's nice, I like this idea. And recognize this person also. Dalai Lama speaks this way. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. And it's, right, there's a lot in that little statement. Commonly, just by definition, compassion means you have concern for others. You're aware, you feel for them, and you want to do something. So, wanting to make others happy, be compassionate. And if you want to be happy, be compassionate. Because we all have the experience when it's a, according to the teaching of Bhagavad Gita, there are modes of nature. And one of the modes of nature is the mode of goodness. And the mode of goodness, one who is in the mode of goodness is compassionate, but they're also conditioned by a sense of happiness. The person that wants, if you want to be happy, be in a quality of goodness. And part of that is to be compassionate, you'll experience happiness. Because when we go out of our way, we all have the experience, you do something specifically to give some act of kindness to another person, and you feel something. You feel happiness. It's universal. So, if you're wanting others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. And here's a statement that Christ made about compassion. You would expect that he made a number of statements. Here's one. Knowledge and ritual without compassion is empty. So when one thinks of religion, when we think of Christ, we think of one of the major religions of the world. We saved some seats for you up front. Front row. Thanks. Just don't trip over the cord that pulls the plug on the projector. Okay. In religion, there is ritual. One experience I have of that is at our, in a number of temples, school professors and high school teachers and so forth, they bring their students to our temple to get an experience, to expose their students to Hinduism. And they come at a time when we're doing our rituals because they want to educate and expose, broaden the experience of their students to the rituals of Hinduism. So they come at deity greeting, then guru puja, then class, and then we have a little class and give them prasadam and off they go. That's the time generally to come. And their questions and their, like, their antenna is up in relation to our rituals. They want to know what's the ringing of the bell and what's the, you know, color of your cloth and why do you shave your head and, you know, rituals. Or religions have teachings, knowledge. But knowledge and ritual without compassion is empty. The life of those things is compassion. So connect with compassion. And this is Vyasadeva, who is the compiler of the Vedas, and In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it describes why he did it. It was compassion. He had the capacity of seeing past, present, and future equally. Trikala Gya was his capacity. So he looked into the future, and he saw what the future age was going to be like, and it was, yikes, it's really awful. Let me do something for the people of this age, because their memory is very diminished, their good qualities are diminished, their spiritual inclination is diminished, their compassion is diminished, everything is diminished. Let me make this wisdom more accessible to them. So he was a literary person, and what he did was that he took that was present in oral tradition and put it in writing. And he divided it into four and compiled it as an expression of compassion for us. And there's something that he wrote about compassion. Great philanthropic souls travel on earth on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to show compassion to the fallen souls who are averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord. So his expression of compassion was to undergo some personal inconvenience or difficulty for the sake of others, but specific to their disconnect with their relationship with the Supreme. Compassion, in Vyasadeva's sense, is accept inconvenience unto oneself to make connection between the living entity and the Supreme. Because in that disconnect, that's the cause of their suffering. So relieve them of their suffering, make them happy by giving this wisdom. That's through the Vyasadeva. And of course, Krishna was very compassionate in his address to Arjuna, because Arjuna, the colors are really off, but behind Krishna is the universal form. This is a picture, painting, of Krishna speaking to Arjuna, showing Arjuna his universal form, and overall in the Bhagavad Gita, relieving him of the material conception of life and restoring his spiritual conception of self and the goal of life. The quote comes from Srimad Bhagavatam, though, and Krishna is saying, showing compassion to all living entities, you will attain self-realization. Giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self as well as all the universes in me and myself in you. So the universal form, he's showing Arjuna, all the universes are in me and I am within you, and all of that possible, that spiritual enlightenment and realization becomes possible when one has this quality of compassion. Important quality. Taken from the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And this is our founder Acharya, the Prabhupada, who said, that is the definition of compassion. One who cannot bear the suffering of another. And great unalloyed devotees of the Lord are compassionate towards the fallen, and therefore they travel over the world with the mission of bringing souls back to Godhead, back to home. Very similar to what Vyasadeva spoke. So now it was a little humorous section. And compassion is generally thought of as one human being to another human being. But there's also compassion of human beings towards other than human beings. Compassion to species that are becoming extinct. Compassion to the environment. There was one property that we were looking to purchase for a temple. It was such a low price, we were surprised. And when we went to look, why was it such a low price? It's because there were some salamanders on the property. And the environmentalists weren't letting people do anything with the property. Because there were some salamanders at risk. That was very interesting. So we didn't grab that property quickly. But there's also the possibility of animals being compassionate to other animals. That's interesting. And it's depicted this way. Here's a little pussycat. And she's just huddled up by the side of a wall, and his little baby puppy dog, and he's wondering, what's this pussycat going to do? And he's just this little baby puppy dog. But he's very tired, and he sees that she's not going to attack him or hurt him, and so he cuddles up to the pussycat, and they both fall asleep very happily with one another. That's a little different. Baby monkey and maybe it's a dove or whatever. And you don't think of giraffes as compassionate, but there's a compassionate giraffe cleaning a little squirrel. The squirrel doesn't seem to mind it. And here's a hen sitting on a little baby puppy. So compassionate, she's even leaving her own little chick alone and making sure the baby puppy is okay. I don't know the name of these animals, but I've seen animals do this.
What are they?
Meerkats.
Well, that's a cat right there.
They're called meerkats, the other ones.
Okay, meerkat? Okay. Well, they stand up on their hind legs because they're like scouting out to see if there's some danger. And so this one's like fully standing up, and here's the assistant. Meerkat and cat. But it's not always like that with animals. It's often like this. So you want to stay away from that kind of behavior, animal to animal, or human to human, or this side of compassion. So I'm sharing a little bit along with the heading, contemporary exhibitions of quality compassion. Here's one that some of you may also be familiar with. Marshall Rosenberg is from somewhere in the southeast and southwest U.S., and his field is nonviolent communication. Just like in Buddhism, a principle in Sanskrit is ahimsa, or nonviolence, or showing compassion. But showing compassion doesn't mean just like doing something that's physically hurtful to others. You can, with speech, do things that are hurtful to others. So you give seminars. I know one, a friend has taken a seminar that lasts 5 days. He spent 5 days with Marshall Rosenberg learning like this. And he showed me some of his videos, and this, he goes with puppets, and this jackal speak is this guy. And so he says, when you want to communicate something, you can say it in a harsh way, and it's rah, 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 rah. And he says the message. So you can say the same thing in a harsh way, or a hurtful way, or an aggressive way, or the way a lot of people speak, and it's violent. It says the information is one thing, but how you speak is violent, can be violent or not violent, aside from the content of the message. In Krishna's words in Bhagavad Gita, austerity of speech is to speak the truth palatably. It's one thing, it's a quality of goodness to speak the truth and not lie. But how do you speak the truth when for the other person it may be uncomfortable? Sometimes people just don't say it. But how do you speak the truth palatably? It's challenging. Can be. But that's what nonviolent communication is. And it's a contemporary example of compassion in the form of speech. Another is social activism. I'm sure here at the Ann Arbor campus there is social activism, so I don't need to explain it. But as I've traveled about, the younger generation of people in particular are very keen on various forms of social activism. It was 3 years ago, the entering freshmen in a number of universities in America and a similar study in Europe, they were asked the question, what's the criterion that you're using for deciding the career that you want to develop through your education? And the answer was, that which is going to make a difference in the quality of the life of the world around me. So the sub-question after that is, well, what about how much money you make? No, that's not the consideration. I want to, and they repeat what their purpose is. They may not have a specific, they may or they may not have a specific area, but preponderance of, this was a 3 years ago study, and I don't think it's changed so much since then. Prior to that, it was job security, stability, all those, you know, those kinds of things. And a lot of people that I met, I asked them when they're graduating, what's your plan? Come, you know, what's next? I'm going to go join the Peace Corps. Or, you know, just give 2 years of my life and, you know, receive very little. I might say, anyway, it's just a trend. Some number of years ago when I was in undergraduate school, this was a really big thing, and I didn't even hear the name Peace Corps until recently. It just kind of was emerged again. Didn't die, it just wasn't as popular. Now it's popular. I meet many young people that just go and spend their summers volunteering, doing stuff, because they want to do stuff. It's just like helping good causes. And they're like looking around for that. So you know all this. It's a very, this is a modern expression, a contemporary expression of compassion. Committing my life or giving a portion of my life to acts of compassion to give assistance to other people. Now, the next little section is how do you train or educate compassion? And from what I can understand from those that are in the teaching profession, they're very clear that they don't know how to. They know how to teach behaviors, but they don't know how to teach character. And I was having some discussion about this point. I don't know, a different setting, a different audience. It's in someone's home. There's a large gathering of people. And someone started to convulse in the audience, and I thought they had a medical problem. So I just stopped and said, are you okay? Is everything all right? And she just burst into tears and said, what you're saying is true. I've been an educator my whole life, and the Board of Education, or the State Department of Education, and all educators were pondering on this because Columbine and all those things that happened with you shooting each other, and, you know, wild outbursts of rage, and, you know, you have all this knowledge and education, but you don't have character. So how do we build character? The answer they came up is, we don't know. So I suggested, do you think there may be some correlation between separation of church and state, meaning the education process, you have to keep God out of the schools, and having difficulty developing character? We said, well, we can't even go look at that because there's separation of church and state. Okay. Good luck building character without a source of character. You may be able to teach a behavior, but you know, to have the children raise their hand and not just speak out of turn. How do you teach gratitude? Now, you can teach a child to say, it's universal. When someone gives something to the child, the parent leans over and says, what do you say? And the child goes, thank you. It's like one of those little toys that you tilt it and makes a sound, and the sound comes out. Thank you. It's a behavior, but it's not a quality. And said, please. So how do you teach gratitude or respect or compassion? The Vedic wisdom has an answer to that question. And the answer to that question is through the principle of association. You associate with persons that have that quality. And at least you have the opportunity to develop that quality yourself. And when that opportunity of quality association comes, there's another like sub-point that's very important, and that is your heart has to be open, because you could have good association, but if your heart is closed, you're not going to receive. But if your heart is open and you're in good association, then transformation can take place. And then when your heart is open, and maybe another way of saying the same thing, but there's some faith or trust in that other quality person. These are points, just taken directly from Bhagavad Gita, but also from the experience of life. Faith or trust must be there when there's a good opportunity for association. And in the Vedic model, the teacher-student relationship was more than just, you know, I have some information, I'm the professor, and you're the student, and you're supposed to, like, I dump the information, you get an exam, see if you can, you got it. There's the information transfer. It's not, the Vedic model is, that the relationship between the teacher and student is important, because what's the duty of the teacher, or the professor, or the person that has wisdom, is to develop character. And the character is through that relationship. That's the Vedic model. Now this image has some special importance for me, and that is the very first lecture that I heard my spiritual master speak, he used this image. He did, I wasn't into a PowerPoint presentation, but he described God-centered life. Those of you that are familiar with the Upanishads, the first of the Upanishads is Ishopanishad. The first verse of Ishopanishad is this. He was explaining, Isavashamitam sarvam yatkin chajagatyam jagat. So, he says, supposing we give everybody in the room, he made a motion like this, and supposing we have a pond of water, a lake of water, everybody gets a pebble, and then we say, can you please throw your pebble in the water, let's see what happens. That's what happens. Little, and water splashes, and concentric circles form and go out, and it's geometrically, it's very attractive. Very nice. And then somebody else, okay, can you place your pebble in the water? And same thing happens. And it's again very nice until the two circles collide with one another, and then there's some clash. And then everybody all at once, throw your pebble in the water. One, two, three. What happens is chaos on the surface of the water. And then the alternative is, we agree on a common center, and everyone places their pebble in that one place. And what happens? There's not the chaos. It's the same geocentric, geometric picture, but the circles amplify one another, and there's no clash. So he was explaining, by this God-centered principle, then we maintain our individuality. In fact, we enhance and grow our individuality. But there's no conflict between individuals. It's because there's a common center. So, along with the same idea, the Vedic wisdom has this term svabhava. And there are a number of you who are from India, so you know what svabhava is. But like me, I like Sanskrit words because I didn't know what they meant when I heard them for the first time. And it's really nice because you don't have any preconceived idea about anything. It's a new thing. So here's the new thing, svabhava. Sva means one's own. And bhava means emotion or feeling or, you know, what's inside you. Your svabhava is like how you feel about life, in one sense. And the term svabhava is used in the Bhagavad Gita in four successive verses, describing persons have different svabhava or different nature. Brahma karma svabhavajam, kshatriya karma svabhavajam, vaishya karma svabhavajam, and shudra karma svabhavajam. It means that from one's own nature comes activity. Quality is the source of activity. Depending on the quality inside, that's what comes out. So, here's the different picture to help you understand if you didn't catch that. Here, there's three concentric circles. At the center, this is us. We're a spirit soul. This is the Vedic picture. Covering the soul are gross and subtle body. This is the subtle body, mind, intelligence, false ego, and there's a gross body, that which we can perceive, this thing. earth, water, fire, air, ether. Those are the elements that make it up. Inside, there's a subtle body, and inside, there's a soul. The soul is animating both the gross and subtle bodies. So, the modes of nature act upon matter. They don't act directly upon the soul, but they, this is sattva, is goodness. When goodness is acting upon the mind or upon the gross body, then you're going to get a certain swabhava, and based on that certain swabhava, you're going to get behaviors. Here's the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance, and they act on the material elements. When goodness is acting, then you get behaviors in goodness, like compassion. So this is saying, from the Bhagavad Gita perspective, if you can enhance the quality of goodness in your life, in principle, then compassion is going to flow from that. Behaviors of compassion will flow. So what are some of the symptoms of goodness? Things like cleanliness. You've heard the phrase, cleanliness is next to godliness. Cleanliness, truthfulness, cultivation of knowledge. Here you are, university. But this is particular spiritual knowledge, knowledge in relation to the eternal self. Control of the mind, control of the senses, regulation of habits. You just finished exam period. At exam period at universities, is everything is upside down. When you're, anyway, you know, level program. Late study to complete your paper or study for the exam and get up and like exhausted afterwards. So that's not normal. The mode of goodness is regulation. And there's mode of goodness in eating, mode of goodness in recreation, mode of goodness in happiness, mode of goodness in knowledge, mode of goodness in... Overall, if the mode of goodness is cultivated, then compassion is going to follow. So Bhagavad Gita recommends, explain what the differences are, and he recommends the mode of goodness. And sometimes the other modes are competing. But if we work towards this end, this is just on the material side, we're going to get to the soul side in a moment. But the quality of compassion is likely to come. So compassion is a trait of the quality of goodness. And here's a little story, I'll make it quick, from Srimad Bhagavatam about one king who was a very great king, but part of his greatness was he was very compassionate. Particularly, he was very generous. Whatever he had a treasury, he had royal treasury, and he would generously distribute that treasury to his citizens. So one of the things, not just like goods and gold, but he distributed his piety. So one of the things that he did was he engaged in austerities, and from those austerities he would get some piety, and from that piety he would then literally distribute the fruit of his piety to his citizens, the persons he was giving protection to. So they would be protected by his piety. He was a really good king. Everybody loved him. And his capacity for austerity was enormous. He one time planned to have a 100-day fast. He's a king. He's got everything. But the austerity of, we've all done some fasting from time to time, maybe have a day, maybe more than that, but I mean, his capacity was enormous, 100-day fast. We could put. We tried to do that. But he was very strong. At the end of the 100-day fast, he was breaking the fast. They made a royal feast, they sat him on a royal seat, and in front of him was a royal array of his feast, and he sat down in the morning to break the fast, and just as he was sitting down to break the fast, a mendicant, a brahmana, came into the palace immediately, because he's king, he's noble, he's virtuous, he immediately got off his throne and honored the brahmana, and asked the brahmana, would you do me this great pleasure? You break the fast first, I've been fasting for 100 days, and if you took first, that would be so wonderful. So he sat down and ate half of what was there and left the other half. And the Brahmana left. So he went to sit down to take the other half. And just as he was sitting down to take the other half, a man came with a bunch of puppies. And the man said, "Oh, my puppies are very hungry. Can I have something for my puppies?" The king said, "Certainly, I have something right here. I'll just give you what I have on my plate." So right from his own plate, he fed the puppies. And there was nothing left except a glass of water. Because he hadn't even had water. So he was ready to take the water. And just as he was ready to drink the water, the very poor man, an impoverished man, came, "I'm thirsty. Grab some water." Then he spoke something very relevant to the point of compassion. He said that anyone that is given the opportunity by nature's arrangement, by the will of providence, to do something, to sacrifice of themselves for the well-being of others, how fortunate. How fortunate is such a person. I am considering myself so fortunate to be able to render these services to these other persons. And the man took the water. And as you can see from the painting, here is Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Indra isn't pictured, but those three personalities that came, they were those three demigods who wanted to examine. They heard about this king, Nimi. But what's the extent? Everyone's got a breaking point. They can be nice up to a certain point, then that's it. It's too much. But King Nimi didn't have a breaking point. So they honored him and said, "This quality that you have will carry you beyond the cycle of birth and death, because you're simply concerned, like these other quotes that you saw, with the real thing, real compassion for the well-being of others." A contemporary example certainly is Mother Teresa. She dedicated her life. She became famous in the world for her capacity for compassion for others. But it's not always just giving food and clothing and shelter to people that are in a difficult situation. Here's a king, Parikshit, who is showing compassion because this person here, personality of Kali, was using this club to break the legs of a bull brutally. He's the king. When he heard that this was going on in his kingdom, he was enraged. To give protection to others may also be an act of compassion if it's your duty to be a king. If you're not a king, you don't walk around with swords and chop people. But it may be, if that is your duty, to give protection, as a king is to give protection to his citizens, to protect them from the vices of that bring great pain and suffering to others. So the last section is this. A question that I've had, my personal question, is compassion is, and this was what I was thinking also to some extent as the, in my role as a chairman 2 years ago, can compassion be misplaced? There's an example that our spiritual master would commonly give, that of compassion for a drowning person. We have this little skit. I'll just do it a little bit dramatically. There was one devotee who, in the middle of a public assembly at our Sunday feast in Brooklyn, New York, he was, anybody that knew him, he was a little, what's the word? A little enigmatic personality. It's like, you know, a little eccentric. So one time in the middle of the Sunday feast lecture, that the sannyasi was sitting giving the lecture, and he started crying out, "Help! Help!" right in the middle of the class. It was staged. And everybody, like, stood up. They thought he was... So, you know, the sannyasi got off the seat and said, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And he said, "Help!" So just like, he took his sweater or his chadar and brought his chadar back and sat down in the speaker seat. It was like, it was done dramatically to demonstrate. When the person is asking for help, you don't just take their outer garment and rescue their outer garment. When the drowning man is drowning, you bring back his coat to the shore. That's nice, but what about the drowning man? So the person is in a suffering condition that you're feeling compassion for. Make sure you know who they are. Not just the external feature, but the person within. Compassion is meant for the soul, is the idea. That's misplaced compassion. When it just goes to the covering of the soul, the body of the mind, which puts you left of the soul. Here's another personal example in my life. I grew up in upstate New York. Detroit's not so far away from that. In the area of around Syracuse is the Finger Lakes. That's where I grew up, one of those Finger Lakes. So in that area of the country, there was a, there's a term for it, an infestation of locusts. Locusts are these little guys with little wings, and in a cycle of 11 or 12 years, something like that, there's like a swarm of them, thousands and thousands and thousands, so many, it looks like night only is daytime because they cover the sky. And they land on agricultural fields and just eat everything. And you can hear them. And it's all gone, and they fly to the next agricultural field, and they fly to the trees, and everything gets stripped. And that doesn't happen again for another 11 or 12 years. So I was 5 or 6 years old when that happened in upstate New York. And so my parents gave me a service that they shouldn't have done for that age. They gave me one of those plunger things, a bowl of liquid in the end, it was black flag, poison, to spray in the garage so the locusts wouldn't come in the garage. So that was spraying in the garage, and I saw a cat. I was thinking, very compassionately, let me spray the cat so the cat won't have a problem with locusts. And that was the end of our cat. Next morning we got up and it was the cat dead in the garage. I felt terrible. That's not the cat, that's just a picture of a cat. I felt awful. You can imagine, 5-year-old, 6-year-old boy just killed his cat. Like a nice kitty cat. So I learned the lesson at the expense of the cat that good intention is not good enough. Or compassion can be misplaced. So that has stayed with me. Like, I want to be sure if, as you progress in the quality of goodness or in spiritual life, quality is something that naturally is there. And how do you properly repose that? Krishna is speaking to Arjuna on the same point. He's speaking very compassionate words about why he doesn't want to take part in the battle that's about to begin. And Krishna is explaining to him what this principle of compassion is, and starting with what the soul is. If you miss that element, like the drowning man, or if you miss the element of what the real object of compassion is meant to be, then the tendency can be misplaced. It's easy for it to happen. And here's a nice story. I'll do it quickly. This is Bharat Maharaj. Those of you that are from India, you know who Bharat Maharaj is. But he was so great that they didn't just name, like I just noticed, we're coming into Eisenhower Street. Or when I was little, it was Idlewild Airport, and then John F. Kennedy became president, and he was shot, and it became JFK, International Airport. You know, after a great person, a place is named, or street, or building, or something, but he was so great, the whole planet was named after him. And he had attained during his reign as king highest stages of spiritual enlightenment. He turned over his kingdom to his 5 sons and then in turn went to the forest to achieve spiritual perfection. There you see the contrast is not so good, but it's Lord Vishnu. He was meditating upon Surya Narayan by chanting a Gayatri mantra. And he was experiencing that the presence of the Lord before him, he was exhibiting symptoms of ecstasy and love of God. It was not fair. Circumstance had it that one morning, early in the morning, he went to the river to take his bath and was performing his meditation on the bank of the river. On the opposite side of the river, there was a pregnant deer. And as a pregnant deer, you've seen how deer do that. They eat something and look up, and she was drinking water and looked around, fearful. And just as she was in one of those taking some water, there was a loud roar, louder than that, a lion roared so loud, she had a miscarriage. And our acharyas described that when women are pregnant, they should be spared from shocking or traumatizing experiences, because the result could be miscarriage. And that's what happened to the deer. Right there she had a miscarriage, and she jumped. Just with the sound, she jumped and she landed right in the river. The river was moving very swiftly. She drowned in the river, was washed to the shore, crawled just enough into a cave by the side of the river and died. And there goes the little baby deer that was just born, carried by the waves down the river. And here's the king watching all this happening. So what did he do? He went and rescued the baby deer. And as he did that, he recognized the king's duty is to give protection to the citizens. And although I'm no longer the king, my sons are the king, it's still my nature. And this is my duty. How could I would be neglectful of my duty if I didn't do this. So as time passed, he became so absorbed, became deer conscious instead of Krishna conscious. And even when he was doing his religious activities, his mind was elsewhere, thinking, is the deer safe? Is everything okay? He couldn't properly concentrate. In the course of time, he stopped his practices. He even lost completely his meditation. His goal of life just evaporated. One evening, the deer didn't come back. So he started this whole monologue about, oh, I have offended the deer. I haven't served properly, and therefore the deer has been offended and the deer is gone. But the deer is such an elevated and kind, considerate, forgiving personality. Surely the deer will come back, and you know, deer this and deer that. Absorbed all night long, the deer didn't come back. So he went searching for the deer early in the morning, and as he was searching, he fell off a cliff by mistake. And when he fell to the bottom of the jagged rocks below, he was thinking of the deer. And when he was thinking of the deer, as the soul left the body, he received the body of a deer. And because he had been in such an elevated spiritual status before that, he was endowed with a special capacity to remember his previous life as the king. So he lived out a full lifetime as a deer. He went back to that place, the very same hermitage, Pulaha Ashram it's called, by the Gandaki River. And there he associated with the sages. He heard them. He took remnants of their food. He's like hung out, being like a, you know, very peaceful deer for a whole deer lifetime. And fixed on not letting this mistake happen again, his next life he became the son of a brahmana. And in the course of that life, he instructed the next king in transcendental knowledge. So the reason for narrating this story is, it's an example of compassion that looks like the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do to help the helpless deer. But to the extent where you lose track of your spiritual well-being and that other living entity's well-being, spiritual well-being, and losing track of the goal of life and God conscious pursuit, he consciously, he rationalized the whole thing away. It's just like he stopped it. So that's misplaced compassion. And there was a consequence for him for doing that. Compassion may look good, but if it's minus the spiritual dimension, it can have complications. Okay, here's the last section. On the spiritual platform, we spoke about swabhava being related to the modes of nature and the gross and subtle body. Is there a swabhava of the soul itself beyond the influence of the material quality and goodness? I explained from quality comes behavior. So beyond material quality and goodness, is there something that's intrinsic to the soul that's like compassion? There's a field of self-compassion that's becoming contemporary. Here's an example of it. You can't read what it says up here, but there's some print. This is a person who is a counselor or a therapist of some kind, and she's found that sometimes it's very difficult to help people because either one of two things. They're so busy putting themselves down, there's no way that they can receive help or be of help to themselves. So the subtitle here is something like stop beating yourself up and exercise compassion for yourself. He explains the principle this way. Supposing you're sitting with a friend and the friend tells you some misfortune has come to them. Some accident, some calamity, some great loss, some tragedy, something. And you're hearing your friend and you feel something. So as you feel compassion towards another, that self-compassion is when that sense, that misfortune may come to you, administer some dosage of self-compassion. It's not, so here's a doubt. Is self-compassion real compassion, or is it just narcissism, just people that get wrapped up in themselves? The answer is it can be narcissism, unless it's on the platform of the soul. If you have a spiritual conception, then the soul, as other souls, so myself, I'm in this situation where I'm in a material atmosphere and it's uncomfortable. I don't belong here. Like a fish out of water belongs in water. Give amenities to the fish and try to make the fish comfortable very compassionately. The best thing is put it back in water. It'll be very happy. So, we have to take self-compassion to the spiritual platform. Here's the Vedic picture. I'm wrapping it up. The Vedic picture of time is that time is cyclical, and the present time that we're in is the age of Kali, and it's a very most difficult. Just like Vyasadeva looked ahead and saw what the age was, and yikes, terrible situation. Let me do something. So in this present age, how to find that good association that will help you become of the quality of goodness, quality of compassion? Or look around you and try to help others come to that quality of compassion, and it's very, very difficult. Persons that are even interested in that in a genuine way on the soul platform, it's very rare. So the Vedas look at this problem and they suggest the following remedy, that there's a special dispensation or measure for this age, and that's spiritual sound vibration. Here's a quote from Srimad Bhagavatam. Simply by chanting the Hare Krishna Mahamantra, one can become free from material bondage and be promoted to the transcendental kingdom. This is in that section of the Bhagavatam that's describing the age of Kali and then describes the cure, the remedy for this age. And it works. Persons that, when Srila Prabhupada came to the West and associated with young people that were often quite confused and misguided, through Sankirtan, very jubilant and joyful, the nature of the soul awakens. And aside from that, Sankirtan process is a solitary practice. And in any tradition of the world, it's not just the Hare Krishna mantra, but calling upon names of God. And that's the last slide. Back to thinking of the image of spiritual compassion, the spiritual compassion of Krishna, that he's forever inviting us to come again to that position, natural position. And by directing consciousness to the Supreme, that quality of compassion is felt within us. You have to receive it in order to have it and in order to give it. So awaken that dormant consciousness and compassion is yours on the spiritual platform. So there's some thoughts on this topic of this evening. Hare Krishna. Hit the lights?
Yeah.
What's up? Okay, so I expected there was going to be like a handful of people because it was graduation today and everyone's gone. Look at all these people here. Thank you all for coming. Honored to be with you. Any comments or questions? Yes.
How long is the Kali Yuga?
It's another 427,000 years. 5,000 have passed, and it's 432,000 long. So another 427,000 years of Kali Yuga.
So there's no intervening period?
Yes. Yeah. During the first 10,000 years of that 432,000 year period is called a golden age within the Iron Age, or at least for those who take advantage of this process that I just described, taking shelter of spiritual sound vibrations, specifically invoking or hallowing and praising God's name. Those persons are lifted out of that circumstance. That's the golden age within the Iron Age. And following that is a sharp drop off.
One second question, if I
yeah,
can.
Yeah, sure.
You illustrated about the universe being like a coconut.
Yeah.
And that beyond that coconut is the layers of the spiritual sky.
Layers of the material universe. Layers of the material universe.
Okay.
And beyond that is
beyond
the spiritual
that is
sky.
The spiritual sky.
Yeah.
Have modern scientists, through their instruments, even observed the spiritual sky at all, or they're
no.
still in the material universe?
Yes. I'll tell a little story. The punchline is material science cannot enter into that realm just by nature. So when I was in high school, as a senior in high school, in our school we took part in the American Field Service, AFS. Do you do that here in Michigan? American Field Service is an exchange. Some students go abroad and study, some students come to your school and study. So that year somebody went to somewhere and a student from Japan came and stayed in our home. His name is Kent Ijiri. And brilliant. Brilliant. I mean, brilliant. So, his life went one direction. He went on to get 3 PhDs. And my life went a different direction. I went and became Hare Krishna devotee. And his third PhD was here at Ann Arbor. The first was at University of Tokyo in physics, the next one was in mathematics, and the third was in biochemistry. The third PhD was using physics and mathematics, studying the cell division of a frog. Like, what happens when one cell divides into two? That was his PhD. Biochemistry, math, and physics. So when he finished his third PhD here in Ann Arbor, I was in New York and he wanted to come and visit me in New York. I hadn't like seen him in whatever number of years it was, 12 years at least. And he wanted to see the Statue of Liberty. And I lived in New York and I had never seen the Statue of Liberty. But I said, come and, you know, we'll go look at the Statue of Liberty. And we got there and I didn't want to go. I said, like, let's just, there it is out there. We went to Battery Park. So, in the course of traveling with him, I asked him what he had been doing. He told me. And then I asked him the following question. I said, supposing the principle behind the salvation of a frog was on a spiritual dimension, maybe something like a soul entered because certain conditions were there, and that's the reason, that's like the catalyst that made the cell divide into two. Now you have two souls. His answer was a very honest answer. He says, science can't even look at that question because it's not measurable. And I said, I thought, this is an honest answer. And so there we were, you know, either it's all there is matter, the laws that govern matter, and that's all there is, that's mechanistic science. And I'm wasting my time. Or he's wasting his time. Because, you know, he can't get to the conclusion that there is something else because he can't even look at it. It's from material science. He can't even look at it. It's not measurable. Brilliant. Nice. You know, nice wife, nice son, very kind. So there's no way to validate or invalidate the soul or the spiritual sky or anything in that dimension, the spiritual dimension. By inference, there can be some indicator that there's something. Like intelligent design is one of those. Inference, it's a law of physics. It's a law of science, inference by the most logical explanation. The information content with DNA, there's three choices. It had to be that way. It's just a law of nature. That's it. Like, you know, the crystal shell, or this crystal of salt, because of the bonds of the atoms, it has to be like that. Just has to be like that. Or it's just an accident. It's a random event that just, it came out like that. Or a third is, it was designed. There's an intelligent design, and that's why it came out that way. So that's what the intelligent design folks say, and you know, modern science doesn't like that. They say it's cloaked theism. Anyway, we can't prove it or disprove it. But by inference, it's the most plausible explanation. The other explanations are not at all plausible. In Bill Gates' terms, there's more information in a strand of DNA than all of my 30,000 employees have put together in the course of their lifetime of Microsoft in one strand of DNA. And the people that work for me, they're very intelligent. So that information content in that one strand of DNA has a designer behind it. Microsoft didn't just, it's not, it had to be, or it's just chance. There's design. People work hard and get paid handsomely, lots of profit for that intelligence. Anyway, it's inference by the most plausible explanation. Anything else? Yes?
When you were talking about teaching character, when you were talking about how that was to be learned through principle of association by being around other people.
Yeah.
You said the key to that, though, is to have an open heart. Is that something you think can be taught, to have an open heart, or is that something that's kind of like on the individual to do? And either way, what does that consist of?
That's a great question, because I just spent 3 days discussing with two people what that means. So there is a way to, I mean, you can explain what it is, and you can explain what it isn't, but it's like you can take a horse to water but can't make him drink. There's something that somebody has to want to do. So, you know, one of the persons I was speaking with, they understood that their heart was closed, and they explained why, what their feelings are. And they're describing, you know, like they try to, but it's like, they're stuck. And then, so then they keep, and they try, and they're stuck, they try, and they're stuck. But, you know, it's a step to know that their heart is not open. They go, like they describe the relationship between themselves and their wife. And when wife does this, I just close. And then the wife realized, when I do this, my husband just closes. So I better stop doing that. But, you know, so he stopped closing, but he's not yet open either. Because if she did it again, he would close again. So, you know, staying open is something that's, it's the example that I gave is like going into a forest and there's no trail, just forest. So what do? You just keep moving up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. Eventually you get a trail. So something that's like wild and unrestricted, and even tendency is like, let me get out of here because I'm afraid it's a wild forest. Stay. Be purposeful. You cultivate. You can cultivate that quality. But left on the person was saying, left on my own, I wouldn't make a trail. I just like stay closed. So you can help a person. You can mentor a person. You can give association to help. Help that process. But there's nothing that can be replaced from free will exercising that need open. I feel vulnerable if I'm open, so I don't know, how open I want to be and how trusting I want to be, and maybe something can hurt me if I'm open. So it's a gradual process, but it will be to the degree that it's effective. It's that person that they're in the association of who is trustworthy, and they can feel some trustworthiness towards that person. And then openness. And wow, it feels different. Feels good. And I'm not sure I can trust it, so I close again. That's like, it's a gradual process. But yes, through association it can be. And some persons are by nature more, some persons are by nature less open. The world is very, very hated. Yes.
In the duration of the past 6-7 months, I've met a lot of people in a curriculum here, but there's one person who I consider my friend. Okay. I've found him very skeptical about Vedic teachings, and he wants to understand everything by logic. And I mean, he said that at the end, I'm extremely skeptical. So I happen to know a little bit about the subject matter also, like by attending some satsang,
Okay.
I tried to explain him, but he's like, I'm extremely skeptical.
He's well defensed.
And the thing is, So I think, my understanding is that he's very close. Definitely, he's not open-hearted to receive it at this point. But how can the mind be conditioned, or how should we approach
a person like him or him specifically to help him open up a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I'm sure you face people like that every
day. Oh, yeah.
It is extremely difficult, I know. I don't need to explain that to you.
Yeah. Well, it takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of purity. A lot of purity. Because if from another person's side there's less than purity, that's going to be focused upon. And, the distrust, the lack of trust, the testiness will be there. Even through logic, you can help a person that's very logically based understand the limitations of logic. Einstein was one that understood it. Who was more brilliant than compare your friend to Einstein, what did Einstein say? The more I understand how tiny I feel, before the greatness of God, like a small child of an ocean shore. So humility is a quality that for an intelligent person can help put things in proper perspective. Without humility, then one becomes very invested in pride in that gift that Krishna has given them, in their intellect. I spent some time this past week with someone that's not quite like that, but like his success in his career and in life and education has been, he's really, well, he's quick, very sharp in his intelligence. And with that, but because there's some softness, he can understand that's limited. It's not by the ascending process that I'm going to understand the unlimited. How can the limited understand the unlimited? The answer is you can't. Okay, then nobody can know. So who are you to tell me? Are you limited or unlimited? You know, this intelligent person will say things like that.
Yeah, exactly. He gives the same kind of logic. He says, you also have flaws. You also have flaws.
That's right.
So who's to say that you're right? So, I mean, at some point, I just
I would suggest for you that you just listen to Srila Prabhupada have these kinds of just today at lunch, I was taking lunch and was listening to a recording of Prabhupada, I was speaking to a person who was just like that. He was challenging, and Prabhupada was saying, on what authority are you speaking? You're speaking the authority of the American scientists, and I'm speaking on the authority of Krishna. So let's compare the quality of the American scientist and the quality of Krishna. You've got your authority that you like. I've got my authority that I like. And I'm the authority. Because he was saying, how can you say the thing that you're saying? And I'm just speaking the words of Krishna. So he gave the same example. I may be an imperfect person. But I speak the words of a perfect person. My speaking is perfect. I'm not perfect. But the words are perfect. It's the words of a perfect person. He gave the example. He said, just like if I'm a little boy, or a little boy asks his father, what is this? And his father says, this is a ring. We don't have a ring, but what is this? It's a ring. So I just say, I'm a small child, and I say, that is a ring. On the authority, my father said, it's a ring, so it's a ring. I may even know what rings are, just say, it's a ring. Speaking is correct. On the authority of. So, his authority, the intellectual person's authority, is his mind and his intellect, and that's his authority. And then somebody else has a mind and intellect, and that's their authority. And so somewhere there's somebody that has more intelligence and more intelligence and more intelligence, and whatever that superlative intelligence is, that's Bhagavan. By definition, whatever, whoever, that's what it is. And that's the best authority. Not his intelligence, or the next one that's more intelligent, the next one that's more intelligent. That's just logic. So, if I speak the words of Bhagavan, and another fellow is speaking of what's coming from his intellect, just stepping back without, like, you know, being a referee, which is the better principle to follow? Use his intelligence and ask that question. That's what Prabhupada did with this man in the audience. It was like carrying on. Loud. The principle of coming in contact with the Supreme Pure makes us pure. So the best thing that you can do is come in contact with the Supreme Pure, and as you become pure, you can be an agent to help your friend or people like your friend to become pure. That's the best thing you can do. Good luck. It's challenging to become pure. It's more challenging to become pure than convince somebody that's got, you know, a strong intellect. Because you may be able to defeat somebody that has a strong intellect and show something else that they say, okay, I accept that, than it is to become pure. But if you become pure, then the other can be more readily accomplished. Anything else? Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
How do you respond in a situation where... how do you respond in a situation where you repeatedly show someone compassion, but they're very close up to it, and somehow are not accepting the compassion? Everyone has a breaking point, but do you repeatedly keep showing that compassion?
Of course.
What if they're very negatively close up to it? To receiving compassion, how do you open your mind?
Yeah, those are two different questions. One question is, what should you do? And the other question is, what can you do to help them receive compassion? Here's my experience. Behind the closeness, there's a soul. The soul is recognizing. Some like a child will sometimes just misbehave. Part of the signal is, do you really love me? If I do this bad thing, you still going to love me? Do you really love me? What's your breaking point? So it may be misbehavior. It may just be like a wall. I've been hurt so badly. I just don't want to let anything in. But behind that wall, the person is feeling compassion, maybe your compassion for them. They're not externally acknowledging it, but internally, it's accumulating. And Krishna is certainly knowing. That's something that you can take shelter of, so that you can continue to show compassion even if there isn't any reciprocation at all. It's a service. It's not what you get from the service that keeps you doing the service. It's the service. You're serving Krishna. And one of the things that helps a person get beyond that shut off, closed position is to see that you're trustworthy. You really mean it. It's unconditional. Like the child that's acting up. So there's something with a child that's acting up that a parent can do. Can't you sit down with the child and explain? And then explain and explain, or just show compassion, but not just give a rational picture, a reasonable picture of why this is hurtful to you and to others. When you pull your brother's ear and you hit him, that's hurtful. Supposing it was the other way around. If you were your little brother and someone was pulling their ear and hitting you, how would you feel? So that's not do that. And so on and so on and so on. But it's you can think of creative, you can think out of the box a little bit of different ways that compassion can be shown, other than just one particular way that compassion can be shown. Maybe the back door is open, maybe the window is open, maybe the basement is open, something. You can try different approaches. But be consistent, be genuine. That will help you become very genuine in your approach. Anything else? Okay. Yes?
Like you said, that before we exhibit compassion, we have to become pure and we have to also have a spiritual conception.
And I also said you have to receive compassion before you can get compassion. Go ahead.
So, while, and then you also hear sometimes that still, while we are not completely pure, we should try to...
Yeah, it's part of the process is you receive, you give. You get some purification, you try to act on that platform of purification, and it expands the purification. It's not a one or zero. It's a gradual process. A dimmer switch, not a wraparound switch.
To continue to whatever
yes.
is our capacity.
And the strength for doing so and the impelling force for doing so is the instruction to do so. Instruction from Krishna. Whatever capacity you have, you offer that to him. With your whatever sincerity is in your heart, you offer to him. You act with others on that platform to your capacity, and your capacity will grow. Okay, I think we're done.